supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we are going to talk about fall leaves, the best way to shred them up, and the cold, hard reality of making compost in a cold climate. It's often not ready until a year later. And what do you do with it then? We're also going to talk to a researcher who has disturbing new findings about the emerald ash borer, whose appetite seems to be expanding. That's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Barbara, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Barb. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm hanging in by a thread is the truth, Barb. You know, it's that time of year. But I am better for speaking with you. Where is Barbara?
Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
So what can we do for Barb and Cherry Hill?
Well, this past summer, I had a beautiful mandevilla in a container. And when I bought it, it was on a 3-foot trellis. I immediately added another 3-foot trellis to it. And it kept growing, and I kept pruning, and it kept growing, and I kept pruning. It is still flowering out there now, and it just seems to need to live on, and I hate to let it sit out there all winter in its container and get frozen. So I would love to bring it in the house. I have a spot that does get decent light, and I was wondering, is that practical, or can I actually keep it out on the deck and protect it somehow?
I'm surprised that sucker's still alive. I mean, we've had some very cold nights already, Barb.
Now, well, it's in the corner of my deck, and it's protected by a wall, like a fenced wall, and the garage wall. So it's protected in a little bit of a corner.
If you leave it outside much longer, it will die twice. It will die the first time because it's a tropical plant.
Yes.
And it'll die the second time because it's outside in a container as opposed to having its roots in the ground. Now, you could drop the container into the ground so the soil lines are equal, and then it would only die once. Would that be okay?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. So what you want to do, these things have a tendency to pick up aphids and other hitchhiking pests, and right now there's not a lot else for these insects to do out there. So I want you to bring a hose up to it with a nozzle that you can adjust to a very sharp stream.
Mm-hmm.
And be prepared to get really wet. You know, try to do this on the next sunny day. And
right.
Really hose down every part of that thing.
Okay.
And then
okay.
Get a washcloth and really wipe down the pot as well, including inside the rim. Because a lot of times these suckers will hide on that. And then wait an hour. And then do that again, and then bring it inside. And I mean sharp blasts of water. If you hold this hose nozzle hitting the palm of your hand, it should sting a little bit.
Right, okay.
Yeah, and don't worry about knocking off some leaves or something like that.
Of course.
Bring it inside, and when you bring it inside, you're going to have to put something underneath it to protect the floor, right?
I will, yes.
So you'll have a big dish or you got some container like that.
I will.
And then, you know, water it gently and then feel the weight of the pot. When the soil in the pot is saturated, the pot will feel heavy.
Yes.
Don't overwater. Now, is it near any kind of a heat source, any kind of a vent or anything like that?
I can keep it away from the vent.
Yeah, you should. Very important to keep it away from hot forced air or even cold forced air. If it gets really good light, it could continue to bloom over the winter. These are tropical plants. They don't need a rest period. But what?
That's exciting.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, but normally in a situation like this, with the days getting rapidly shorter and most people not having a real sunroom, more than likely, it's just going to go dormant, which is good. Dormant is much better than dead.
Yeah, definitely. I agree.
So just keep it lightly watered. Don't ever let water sit in the tray at the bottom. Less is more, but don't let it dry out. Don't put it near a heater. If you want to try to make it bloom, go out and get, they've got all these great new LED lights now. You can just aim that right at it and give it like 12 hours of light a day and see what happens. But otherwise, if you just have a gentle hand with it, don't feed it, don't overwater it, mm-hmm. don't underwater it, don't let it get a hot air register near it. You should be able to put it out again next summer. But wait until all threat of frost is over. Wait until nighttime temperatures start to get into the 50s.
I could do that.
All right.
All right. That's wonderful.
Good luck, Barb.
Thank you, Mike.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jerry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you here, Jerry. Where are you?
I am up in near Spokane, Washington today.
Is that not where you live?
No, sir. I live in Rock Hill, South Carolina.
Okay, so are you a truck driver?
I am.
We have so many truckers listen to the show ever since we went on satellite radio.
Right. That's how I listen to it, too.
Yeah, it's great. I never realized there was this subculture of NPR truck drivers. It's very reassuring.
Yes, sir.
All right. What can I do for you, Gary?
Last year in the fall, I was trimming some bushes, and I had a yellow jacket attack.
Ooh.
I saw them come up out of the ground, and I ran from them, but they still bit me a couple times. I got away from them, and then I poisoned them, and I didn't have any more trouble that year. But this year, about 2 weeks ago, I was trimming another bush about 10 feet from where the other bush was, the trim before. It may be a coincidence, but the same thing happened again. And I'm wondering, is there anything I need to do to keep these things away from me?
Well, I think you ought to give up pruning as a hobby, Jer. I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, you're pruning plants close to your home, right? You're on
yes.
your property. So
yes.
what you got to do is before you go into a thing, you just have to look down at the ground because especially in your climate in the Carolinas, yellow jackets are very active during the day, and you're always going to see one or two coming and going mm-hmm. from the nest.
Okay.
Now, once you find the nest, please don't use poisons anymore because you could kill bees, you could kill owls, you could kill all these beneficial creatures. You could kill the skunks who naturally okay. eat these yellow jacket nests. So a couple of things that we tell people they can do. One is real simple. You can go out and buy wasp and hornet traps or make your own. All you need to do is knock a hole in the lid of a glass jar, and they'll fly into it, and they can't fly out. And then you bait the inside of the jar with like a rotten peach or some cat food and lay that down next to the nest hole, and they'll just fly in there to their death. But as you're watching this, if you can see the nest hole and, you know, they're all coming in and out of one little hole and you have access to it, it seems too simple to believe. But all you have to do is take a clear glass bowl and put that over the hole at night. And then your problems are over. They can't get out. They actually don't dig. The overwintering queen finds a little hole in the ground, and then they use that to construct their nest underground. But once that hole is covered up, they can't dig a way out, and they'll all just die inside the nest.
Well, I had no idea.
Another way that I've gotten rid of them is I have an old canister vacuum in my basement I saved just for this purpose. If I find a yellow jacket nest, I go out to the nest at night. I lay the hose of the canister vacuum down next to the hole. The next morning, I plug it in. They all come flying out of the hole, man, to attack that noisy thing.
Uh-huh.
They all fly inside. When I can't see any more yellow jackets going inside, I plug up the hose, turn it off, just let the vacuum sit out in the sun for a couple of days, and then throw the bag away.
Wow. Okay. That's another idea.
You remind me, there was a company that bought underwriting on our show a while back, but they are called AntZap. The name of the company is AntZap, which doesn't sound like it meets your needs. They make two products, MoleZap and AntZap, and it sounds like they would electrify them, right?
Yeah.
But that's not what it is. They're CO2 canisters. And you get this thing that you can put over the hole in the ground, again, at night when they're not moving around. And then you open up the CO2 canister, and it displaces all the oxygen down in the hole. And they just go to sleep and don't wake up.
Wow. Okay.
And you'd be able to easily find them online. But a glass bowl, a vacuum cleaner, traps, once you know that they're there, they're really easy to take care of. And the answer to your original question is just be more aware.
Well, I really appreciate the help. I'm going to take care of this next time.
All right, Jerry, good luck and drive safe.
All right, thank you, sir. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind our listeners in the enlightened states of Maryland and Virginia that the deadline to feed your lawns for this year has now passed. New laws designed to protect the priceless Chesapeake Bay forbid feeding from now through March. But don't go running for your time machine just yet, because we'll be right back with the cold hard reality of compost making, the new targets of the emerald ash borer, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, makers of Biotone Starter Plus for new transplants, full of beneficial microbes and mycorrhiza for deeper roots and stronger plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a double-barreled question of the week. What do you do with the common problem of compost that is finally finished, just as you need those bins for this year's fall leaves? And what are the best ways to shred up those leaves to try to make this process move a little faster? We'll also get to more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it is time to welcome our special guest, Dr. Don Cipollini, a professor in plant physiology and chemical ecology and director of the Environmental Sciences Program at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio, who joins us through the kind auspices of WYSO. Dr. Cipollini, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I am glad to have you here, sir. Now, I'll get right to the point. I understand that you have news about our dear friend, the emerald ash borer.
I sure do. What we found in a nutshell is that our emerald ash borer that we thought we fully understood at this point after 12 years of intensive study here in the U.S., that it would eat only ash trees. I discovered late last year that it would also use another species, a related species called white fringe tree.
The emerald ash borer is kind of a pretty insect, but its larval stage not only lives in a very delicate part of the ash tree, it actually girdles the tree because it eats so much and makes so many galleries and destroys these trees that are so valuable and so beautiful. How did you find it in the fringe tree?
Well, I guess I could back up a bit about why I looked in the first place, and that would be when I moved to my home here in Ohio, which is actually in Yellow Springs, where I'm recording at the moment. I had to identify this tree in my own backyard as something I was unfamiliar with. And once I did, I started to notice where others of this species were planted in the area. It's native to southern Ohio, but it's also planted ornamentally in this part of the state relatively infrequently. But once you start to look for them, you do see them here and there, and you kind of remember that.
This is one of the top five trees, the fringe tree, that arborists and landscapers who know what they're doing tell me is underutilized because it's such a great tree and people are not as familiar with it as they should be.
That's exactly right, especially as a native North American tree. It's a beautiful ornamental. The flowers are bright white and showy and have fringe-like petals, thus the name fringe tree. They have a great smell in the spring. They flower a little bit later than some of our other spring flowering shrubs. And they also make an olive-like fruit in the fall, purplish fruit that's also attractive itself. So they're a great tree, and up until this find, had been known to be relatively pest and disease-free. I mean, they would need some occasional pruning and so forth, but they were a low-maintenance yet very attractive tree, just at the cusp of growing in popularity. So that makes this find sort of disappointing in that regard.
You know, I've never sniffed a fringe tree. What's it smell like when it's in flower?
Lilac, of course, which is a relative in the same family. It's a very sweet-smelling fragrance, just very pleasing. It's very hard to describe. It's just a very sweet, pleasing fragrance.
No, I can imagine a lilac with like a hint of vanilla in there.
That's fair. Yeah.
That would be almost a perfect fragrance. Now, how did you find it in the fringe trees, or did you find a dead fringe tree and do CSI?
Well, it started as just a curiosity, first of all. If you were to look at whether emerald ash borer was expanding its diet here in North America, this would be a tree you'd look at because it is fairly closely related, or more closely related to ash trees than those lilacs and things that lots of people have been interested in from the start. And so again, knowing where a number of these were planted in my area, I just decided one weekend late last summer actually to go out and decide whether or not emerald ash borer was attacking this tree. And it took me about 30 minutes to find it. And so it just simply took somebody, it could have been anybody, as I say, with the skills to recognize the signs of emerald ash borer attack to find that first tree that had the very obvious, in my case, the first symptom I saw was the canopy dieback in the tree.
Right.
And also the presence of the exit holes that the adults make in the tree as they exit in the spring. So it took 30 minutes to find that first tree. And, of course, that led to work every week since to really further investigate this phenomenon.
So what's your hypothesis so far? Was this an isolated event, or are they expanding their preference? Or is this kind of out of necessity to them as they knock off the ash trees?
Yeah, all very good questions. And I do have a hypothesis so far, and that is the beetle probably came pre-adapted to identify this tree on the basis of what it uses to identify ash trees as hosts and to be able to make a living in ash trees. And one part of that story that we know already, at least we have preliminary data already, is that we've captured what are called volatiles given off by the canopy of white fringe tree. and looked at those in relation to what comes off of ash tree canopies. And these kinds of volatiles are what the adults would use to find an ash tree. And right now, it looks like white fringe tree smells very much like a susceptible ash tree to an adult. You know, it doesn't necessarily need to be a recent adaptation, a movement to white fringe tree, just that they're using some of the same cues they use to find an ash tree to find this related tree, and they can actually make a living on it, as it turns out.
Because one thing I recently discovered doing more research on this insect is it starts with the adults going up to the canopy of a leafy ash tree and nibbling a bit, but mostly looking for mates while they're up there, and then coming down and laying their eggs. And they're, as with adults, it's their children who do the damage to society. You know?
That's exactly right. Yeah, the adults, after they emerge, they have to feed for about 2 weeks during a period that's called maturation feeding, and they sexually mature at that point. And then after that period, they mate and then start to lay eggs. And they'll continue to feed a bit after that point. You know, their whole life cycle might be 5 weeks long or so. But they use these sort of volatile cues coming off of the leaves or bark of their hosts to find the trees in the first place after they emerge. And that's where I think some of the attraction to white fringe tree has occurred.
And is there anything, you know, people right now, of course, who have fringe trees, you know, the envy of their neighbors, they have this special tree, you know, people keep asking them, oh, what is that? It's so beautiful. They're terrified right now. One thing we had discussed would be to spray the canopy of the tree with the new BT, the BT Galleria, which seems to be effective against a wide range of beetles. It was originally developed against Japanese beetles and June beetles and stuff like that, but it turns out to work against the emerald ash borer. You know, the fringe trees are a lot smaller. They're a lot more compact, right?
Yes, they are a much smaller tree. They're even what you might call a large shrub, really, in many cases. They're often multi-stemmed. So a treatment like that, if the adults indeed are utilizing the leaves of white fringe tree, could be effective at knocking those back. There's always the possibility, though, that the adult actually did most of its feeding on a nearby ash tree.
Yeah.
And then moved over and laid its eggs on a white fringe tree. And I think a fair amount of this happens. I do have more hopes that white fringe tree can make it through an infestation and survive than an ash tree can. You can see that they might die back kind of branch by branch, but in an ornamental setting, a horticultural setting, this could be managed perhaps with selective pruning. And the other real difference of fringe tree with an ash tree is that they are very strong root sprouters, stump sprouters, and you could do the technique that's known as juvenility pruning or rejuvenation pruning, to which you can also do with its relatives like lilac and so forth, that you cut back more or less to the base and allow new sprouts to come up. I have hopes that white fringe tree can be managed through this without dying.
But what you're saying is keep an eye, and if you see a damaged limb, get it out of there right away. And I guess you almost have to burn it, right?
Well, that would be the most definitive way of making sure you've killed whatever might be in that branch. And again, I've seen in cases where a very beautiful white fringe tree will, from the outside, will look great, but then there is a branch that's attacked and has been killed back because it happened to get girdled. And so if you selectively can remove those branches, you could probably try to keep the tree as healthy as possible. And again, the other end of the spectrum, as I've indicated, is I've seen trees that show signs that they have been attacked over the last couple of years, but they're still in quite good shape. The tree, as long as they're not attacked too significantly, I think they can remain healthy through an attack. And again, with emerald ash borer, a tree has to be reattacked every year to keep the infestation going. It's not like a disease they catch and it sticks with them. They have to be. There's a period in the cycle where they actually are kind of unattacked for a while. They have to be reattacked each year. And so, you know, even a tree that's been attacked, if it ceases to be attacked or if beetle densities decline, you know, it can recover, maybe to the point of surviving through the invasion wave.
You know, and that's the first rule of organic gardening and farming that I learned, is pay attention. Look at every plant every day. and you're really never going to get caught unawares. And if they find anything, get in touch with you at Wright State University, right? Keep the...
Absolutely. We're very interested in how widespread this phenomenon is. We've seen it across Ohio, out to Chicago, and you know, basically everywhere we've looked where there is sufficient pressure, as I say, from emerald ash borer through time, some percentage of the white fringe trees in that vicinity will show signs that they've been attacked. And so we think it's a widespread phenomenon, but we'd like to further our knowledge about that.
All right. Dr. Don Cipollini is professor of plant physiology and chemical ecology. He is the director of the Environmental Sciences PhD program at Wright State University. He joined us today from the studios of WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. Dr. Cipollini, thank you very much for your good work and stay in touch.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
And now back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Joanna, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, Joanna. How are you?
I'm great. I'm excited to talk to you.
I'm excited to talk to you. Where is Joanna Great?
I'm here in Philadelphia. I'm in South Philly.
Okay. What part of South Philly?
Kind of by the stadium, a little bit north.
That's a nice neighborhood right there, just for people who don't know what we're talking about. All of the Philadelphia sports facilities are clustered at the very southern tip of South Philadelphia. But it's just outside this wonderful residential area.
Yeah, it's a very Italian neighborhood. I often hear Italian spoken in my neighborhood. There's great cannolis in South Philadelphia.
Chocolate mousse. Cannolis from Isgro's on 10th Street. 10th and Christian,
yeah.
Baby.
Yeah, I know that place.
God, now you got me salivating. All right, what can we do for you, Joanna?
Okay, so I have this jasmine plant that I bought maybe about 5 months ago. I've had it in my little like South Philadelphia backyard.
Uh-huh.
I think you can imagine. And it's been really happy. It's been blooming. And so I'm like terrified because I want to bring it in for the winter, but I want to make sure that I bring it in the right way. I don't want it to die, and I want to make sure I put it in the right place in the house.
Did you get this at a supermarket?
I think I got it at, like, Home Depot,
oh,
which surprises
good.
Me.
Good.
Yeah.
No.
But I repotted it carefully.
Okay, good.
And I put some really good compost and just regular soil that I got at Greens Grow.
Okay, so Greens Grow is great.
Yeah, and I asked them what to use, and they told me what to do, and so I repotted it, and it's been happy.
You have to be warned that these are some of the most finicky houseplants, but
okay.
I like what you've done so far. The most important thing right now is, first of all, you want to get it inside soon. We've had some really cold nights, and this is a seriously tropical plant. If you
okay.
were out in the suburbs, you might have lost it already. But in the heat sink of the city, you get another 10 degrees, so you're golden for now.
Should I be bringing it in at night? I've been trying to bring it at night and then like keeping it in the house more and more during the day. Is that how you would do it?
Oh, so you are actually hardening it off. That's actually very smart. That's a clever thing to do while we still have warm days.
Mm-hmm.
What I want you to do most of all, though, is do you have a mm-hmm. hose out there?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Get the hose together, nice warm day, get a nozzle with an adjustable setting, cradle the plant mm-hmm. with one hand, and then really mm-hmm. spray the heck out of it with the sharpest
okay.
stream of water you can get. I know okay. if it's got flowers on it, it's going to blow some of the flowers off, may blow
okay.
off a couple of dead leaves, but jasmine mm-hmm. always comes in infested with aphids, and it just gets really ugly. You might not see them, but you want to give that plant a good blast of water, get a cloth and wipe the pot down as well, and around
okay.
the rim, make sure you're not bringing in any aphids, wait an
okay.
hour, and then do it again.
Okay.
And then bring it in. The best spot for it would be near a sunny south-facing window, but behind a sheer curtain.
Okay, here's what I have as options, though. I have an east-facing window.
That's good. That's
it,
good.
It doesn't get a lot of sun because I live in like a row home. So
yeah,
like
yeah.
First floor.
All you're going to do is try to keep this puppy alive over winter. It's not going to. It's not
okay.
going to look great in February or March. Neither do most of us.
Okay, true.
We can't expect more of our plants than from ourselves. So wash it off really well. I can't overstress that. I love the idea that you're bringing in at night and letting it get some sun during the day. Feel free to take it outside on any sunny day that's in the 50s or above.
Okay.
Because it's tropical. I mean, it doesn't really need the seasons or anything like that. But, you know, if you get bored with that, just, you know, the east-facing window, make sure it doesn't get direct sun. Make sure it's not near a heating vent, forced air, or anything.
It is kind of by a heating vent.
And then you got to find a different place, yeah, because that'll kill it. Find the best place you can for it. Just good light, but not direct sunlight, not total darkness, not near a heating vent or forced air. That's really important. And when we get to the springtime, don't worry if it looks a little shabby. Again, so do most of us. And then don't rush taking it outside. Don't move it outside for good until the nights are in the 50s.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. Good luck.
Bye. Thanks.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will once again have the honor of hosting the Philadelphia Interfaith Hospitality Network's annual Empty Bowl Dinner to benefit families fighting homelessness on Wednesday, November 18th at the Lutheran Theological Seminary on Germantown Avenue in Chestnut Hill. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with cold compost, a hot leaf shredder, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, makers of Biotone Starter Plus for new transplants, full of beneficial microbes and mycorrhiza for deeper roots and stronger plants. Espoma, a natural in the garden since 1929. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to a double-barreled question of the week. Looking at the common problem of your compost not being finished until the growing season is over. What do? You need to empty out those bins to fill them with fresh shredded leaves. And what are the best ways to shred those leaves? We'll answer both of those burning questions after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Jimmy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I am doing well, Jim. How are you, sir?
I'm doing just great.
Okay. And where is Jim doing great?
I'm in Midwest City, Oklahoma.
And is that near our friends in Oklahoma City and Norman?
Well, it's about 20 miles north of Norman.
Okay. And what can we do for you, Jim?
I would like to plant some cherry trees, or at least a couple of cherry trees, not a grove or anything. But I'm not sure what variety of cherry trees that would grow well and produce fruit in this region.
Okay, so you're in Oklahoma, and you're talking about real fruiting cherries, not just the ornamental plants.
Yes.
Okay. The bottom line is that you probably can't grow the sweet cherries that people buy in the supermarket. In your climate, you'd mostly be limited to what are called sour cherries or pie-making cherries. But my opinion of these plants has changed dramatically. I was visiting a friend of mine, and he had a cherry tree in bloom. You know, where we were, I said, I didn't think you could grow sweet cherries here. He goes, they're not. They're pie cherries. And I was eating them fresh off the tree, and they were darn good. They were not sour or astringent or anything. I liked the flavor. And, you know, the latest health food craze replacing pomegranate juice is this sour cherry juice, which is supposed to be a great natural anti-inflammatory. So, I mean, the fruits have a million uses. Couple of problems with cherry trees. The last time I checked, there really weren't any really good dwarf varieties. So cherry trees get very large. You know, they are full-size trees, what we call standard trees.
Yes.
And it might be a little tricky to grow them in your area, but you're going to do two things to kind of help yourself achieve success. Now that you know the basics, which is you're looking for pie cherries, sour cherries, tart cherries, I really think it's very important for you to contact your local extension office, and they will give you what will probably be a very short list of varieties that do very well in your region, your specific microclimate even. Now, with these type of cherry trees, they tend to be what's called self-fruitful. You don't need two different varieties to get cherries. But if they say, okay, well, there's three different varieties that we would recommend, and you intend to put in, let's say, three trees, I would get one of each different variety instead of trying to guess which one is going to do best. Because then, even if one tree fails on you, you'll still have an enormous amount of cherries. The other thing that's vitally as important is you got to plant these in a place where they get full sun, but they are protected from your legendary hellish wind, especially when they're young. That Oklahoma wind, which really does come whipping off the plain, can really brutalize a tree, especially over winter, because you're dry normally, and then you get these desiccating winds, and it's a little easier once a tree gets to, you know, medium to full size, but when they're small, you may even want to put up a windbreak around them the first couple of winters.
Okay, all right.
But the bottom line is you should be able to grow tart cherries for pie making. You'll need to protect them from the wind. Other than that, cherries are a relatively pest-free fruit. You should have good success with them. The challenge will come when they're ripe and the birds come in and try to eat them before you do. Blueberries and cherries, birds are the biggest, quote, problem. Now, one thing that my friend Lee Reich has told me, the fruit grower, is his cherries are so big that there's enough to share. The birds just come in, and it looks like they're stripping the trees, but there's still more cherries than he can pick. But he also says that one trick he learned that reduces their robbing is to just take spools of black thread and keep throwing it up into the trees. And the thread hanging down appears to really confuse the heck out of them.
Oh, that's interesting.
But get a list of recommended varieties from your local extension office, and that'll get you on your best start.
All right, Mike. Well, I do appreciate you taking my call, and I listen to your show pretty much every day.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Jimmy.
All right.
Take
care.
Thank
you, sir.
Bye-bye.
All right, goodbye.
1-888-346-9499. Heather, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Heather. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am just ducky, thank you. Where is Heather good?
I'm in Fredericksburg, Virginia.
What could we do for Heather in Virginia?
I have a lemon tree that was started from a cutting from my grandfather's lemon tree, which is in New Orleans. The cutting had been taken from his tree by my parents who live in Houston and, like, started. And then they brought me, you know, a sprouted cutting this spring. And I just need to know what to do to make it happy plant, because it's not very happy right now, and I don't know what to do with it over the winter.
Right. Well, you don't have to worry, because it'll just die over the winter. I hate to mention this to you. I know Virginia is in the South, and Fredericksburg is even south of D.C., and, you know, but you ain't New Orleans or Texas, honey. Outdoor citrus only really grows well in very warm climates. Most of the outdoor citrus I'm familiar with is in California, and really just southern to central California, not even in northern California. So is this poor tree in the ground?
No, it's in a pot.
Okay, good. And luckily you are far enough south. It hasn't had to experience frost yet, has it?
No, and it was getting a little cold, so I put it in the garage until I figured out what I really needed to do with it.
Okay. One of the issues is when people in your climate, and my climate, want to grow a lemon tree, they go to probably a mail order supplier or go to a garden center and they buy a grafted plant, typically a Meyer lemon, that keeps the plant small. I'm sure the original of this tree is a full-size tree that's like 12 or 14 feet high, right?
Yeah, it's a nice-sized tree.
So the tree would need to come in for the entire winter and live in your house with you. And that'll be easy enough this season, but in future seasons, as the tree gets larger, it'll be physically impossible to move it in and out. And that will probably occur long before you can get any fruit from the thing. So if you want to give it a start, take it out of the garage, take it to some place where you can really wash it down really good, spray it off, make sure you're not bringing any pests in on it, and then bring it inside, give it a gentle feeding. If you have some compost, put some compost on top of the pot. If not, try to find some compost or some worm casting somewhere. Some nice natural nutrition. And then do you have a bright and sunny window where this can go?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, good. Try to keep it at least a foot away from the window, because even the best windows get really cold at night in the middle of the winter. And sheer curtains so that it's not getting direct sunlight on it while it's inside. Lemon trees require a lot more moisture than most plants, so you don't want to waterlog it. But this is a tree that you don't want to underwater. You don't want the pot to get light. If you were to read the book on this, it would say keep the soil constantly moist but not soggy, right? Yeah, good luck with that. But, you know, it means don't have a light hand with the water. But the bottom line is you may get an interesting looking tree out of this. It will need to be potted up into a bigger pot. Again, every year, if it gets healthy, it'll grow a full-size trunk. And it's an oddity, but it's not something that you can eventually move outside and pick lemons off of as if you lived in San Diego or something. But if you wanted to do something, first, you can always buy one of these indoor lemon trees. They have been really bred to help people be successful. And they do produce lemons, and when the flowers open in the wintertime, the scent that fills the house is just incredibly wonderful. And if your grandparents or parents know someone who is experienced in horticulture, what they could do is take the base of one of these indoor lemon trees, the rootstock that keeps it small, and then they could graft a scion of your grandfather's plant onto the dwarfing rootstock. And then if you cared for it correctly, you might have an indoor lemon tree that produces your grandfather's lemons.
Yeah, that would be really interesting.
But you'd need to start them on the right rootstock.
Okay.
Because your tree will grow into a monster if it survives.
Okay.
But again, it can't survive outdoors over winter. So that's the bottom line right now.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Heather.
Well, thanks, Mike.
Take care.
Okay. You too. Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we're going to call Fall into Composting. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's introductory question.
Sure, Mike. Andy in Pittman, New Jersey writes, I composted last year's shredded leaves with coffee grounds, turned the piles, and finally have finished compost. Should I put it on my beds now in the fall? I need to make room in my compost bins.
Well, Andy has discovered the hard reality and awkward timing of composting in climes with cold winters. Although you always get some finished compost by planting time of the following year, a lot of the material won't be done until the weather heats up in late spring and summer. Even with shredding, turning, and adding those nitrogen-rich coffee grounds, I was personally disappointed by the unfinishedness of my compost this spring.
What? Come on, you're the king of compost.
Well, that freezing cold winter put a crack in my crown. On the other hand, once we got to June and July, I was turning new piles of kitchen waste and last year's shredded leaves into finished compost in a month. And, like Andy, I had a lot of finished material that I had to use this fall to make room in my bins. It's all a factor of time and temperature. If we were down in the Carolinas, a much higher percentage of our compost would be finished in the spring. But in cold climes, you just need more time.
So, what did you do? What should Andy do?
You got to use it. I spread most of my finished compost on my raised beds and around my peach trees. I'll try and protect it from leaching with an inch of well-shredded leaves after the soil freezes hard for the season.
Right. Winter mulch should go on after the soil freezes and not before. Now, you just said most. What about the rest of your finished compost?
I'm saving that in an old wheelbarrow with a tarp on top so I can add a couple handfuls into every fresh batch of this year's shredded leaves. The life in that finished compost is a great way to kickstart these new piles.
Speaking of shredded leaves, your anniversary show with Lee Reich and Howard Garrett brought this question from Jill in Chester Springs, PA. Mike and his guests were encouraging the shredding and mulching of leaves, and Mike recommended a heavy-grade machine to do it. What exact unit is recommended?
Well, a bagging lawnmower works well, but my tool of choice has always been an electric blower vac, a dual-purpose machine with one really dumb purpose and one that's essential.
The dumb use would be the blower part?
Right. You make a bunch of noise, blow a lot of junk into the air, and the leaves are still on the ground when you're done. That makes as much sense as taking pork chops to a Seder.
Right. Please don't do that. And the good use is when you switch out a few parts and use it as a leaf vac. That way, the leaves actually get picked up. And these machines automatically shred them into much smaller pieces. As you've said many times, a gardener can save 10 or 12 bags worth of whole leaves in a single bag once they're shredded.
Exactly. Now, there must be a dozen different electric blower vacs out there on the market, and the models are constantly changing. But the first thing you want to look for is a machine that definitely performs both functions. Some of them are just blowers.
But how can you tell for sure?
It should say it right there on the box, and often they got a picture of the collection bag that holds the shredded leaves. Now, I also originally told her to look for a machine that has a high mulching ratio, that a ratio of 10 to 1 would be good and 20 to 1 would be twice as good.
But?
But Hammacher Schlemmer sent me a really neat cordless rechargeable model to test this fall that only claims a 10 to 1 ratio, you know, saying it can only turn 10 bags of whole leaves into one bag once they're shredded. But it's much better than that. It's producing some of the smallest particle sizes I've ever seen. And those particles are significantly smaller than the ones that are coming out of my Toro corded model, which claims 16 to 1. So now I'm not certain that any listed mulching ratio numbers are a good indicator. Instead, I just say to make sure it has a metal impeller and a decent warranty.
So, Hammaker Schlemmer, the high-end catalog that claims to offer the best of everything. Mikey has a shiny new toy. So, what does it cost, and what do the corded ones go for?
Well, you'll typically pay around $100 for a really high-quality corded blower vac. The rechargeable one I'm testing retails for $300, so it's not for everybody. And you're limited to shredding about 3 bags at a pop before you have to stop and recharge the battery. But that charges up again in a little over an hour, and I am just loving being able to get all those leaves that are in places I couldn't reach before with a cord.
Bottom line?
However you do it, shred up all the leaves you possibly can right now, because you need more than you think and you won't get another chance until next year. Well, that sure was some interesting information about fall leaves and compost realities, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to lots of other leaf and composting articles, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to slow down my compost if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email with your location, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore with your location at garden@whyy.org. Oh, and please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares where you are, but where you will find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to email us, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Lauren Elkins keep our website free of fall leaves. The well-composted Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, shreds very easily. Almost finished, Stephen Dre Hobel is our ace production assistant. I'm loving my $300 leaf shredder, Mike McGrath, and I'll cry when I finally have to send that thing back. But I'll recharge myself in time to see you again next week. Interested in using some of your hydrangea blooms as dried flowers? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, a listener reveals how to successfully preserve the many types of these big blooms. Plus your fabulous phone calls.